Hello. This is your Midnight Marauder program. I'm on the front of your cover. I will be enhancing your cassettes and CDs with certain facts that you may find beneficial. The average bounce meter for your Midnight Marauder program will be in the area of 95 BPM. We hope that you will find our presentation precise, bass-heavy, and just right. Thanks.
What's happening, Catskill? You're listening to WGXC Acra 90.7 FM. This is Chuck Ansbacher, Broody Duck, signing off.
You can find out about so many local events, like the traditional Irish music session. Every Sunday, there's an open Irish music jam at the Shamrock House in East Durham from 2 to 5 p.m. Find out more on the WGXC community calendar online at wgxc.org and add your own event to the WGXC community calendar and have it read on the radio at 90.7 FM by going to WGXC.org and clicking on the community calendar.
WGXC underwriting support is provided in part by Crisafulli Brothers Plumbing, Heating, Cooling, and Electrical, Upstate New York's home services company since 1993. Red Carpet Service and Solutions. For more information, visit CRISBRO.com.
Wave Farms WGXC is made possible in part by the generous support of Elizabeth Cortell in Lake Balboa, California. WGXC monthly supporters care deeply about Creative Community Radio. Their generosity and investment keep this unique station viable. You too can become a monthly supporter by going to wgxc.org/donate and establishing a donation at the amount of your choosing. We hope you will do so. Thank you so much for your support.
This is the Public News Service Daily Newscast for June 14th, 2024. I'm Mike Bowen. Legal analysts continue to examine new U.S. Supreme Court opinions issued Thursday. In one of the more high-profile cases, the court unanimously preserved access to a medication that the Associated Press says was used in nearly two-thirds of all abortions in the U.S. last year. Separately, the court made it harder for the federal government to win court orders when it suspects a company of interfering in unionization campaigns. The Associated Press says the case stemmed from a labor dispute with Starbucks. Additional rulings are expected this month. That includes a case brought by attorneys representing Donald Trump, who argue the former president is entitled to so-called presidential immunity for criminal charges he faces related to efforts to overturn results from the 2020 election. The court also is expected to rule any day now on two cases that could allow judges to more easily overrule federal agencies, which could have big implications for environmental, consumer, and public health protections. The two cases aim to overturn the 1984 Chevron Doctrine that said when ambiguous statutes are being challenged in court, judges must defer to the reasonable interpretation of agency experts. Jim Murphy is with the National Wildlife Federation.
It would give judges a lot more power to write very impactful regulatory provisions where those judges really don't have a lot of expertise.
Opponents of the Chevron Doctrine say it gives too much power to the executive branch. The cases stem from a dispute where fishing crews are challenging requirements that they pay to have a monitor on board to guard against overfishing and bycatch of endangered species. Local election administrators have new guidance from Wisconsin's highest court on alternative early voting sites. A political expert says the timing is important for the battleground state ahead of the 2024 presidential election. The Wisconsin Supreme Court this week banned the use of mobile voting sites. But separately, the court kept in place rules that allow clerks to choose other alternative sites for absentee voting. University of Political Scientist Barry Burden says that means these offices will still have flexibility as they sort out logistics.
They face a lot of difficulties trying to find sites that are available. You know, they're often repurposing a church or a school or a community building.
With the Supreme Court pausing a lower court's ruling that heavily restricted these other sites, Burden says clerks won't have added confusion as they meet deadlines for this year's election.
The case has to do with the interpretation of state law that prohibits alternative sites from being set up in areas that give one political party an advantage over another. Burden and other political observers still expect the Wisconsin Supreme Court to issue a ruling soon in a case that seeks to reinstate ballot drop boxes. This is PNS. The city of Boston has been awarded nearly $10 million in federal funding to help build a climate-ready workforce. Catherine Carley reports.
More than 1,000 individuals will receive job training in construction, wastewater management, and more to combat the growing threat of sea level rise. U.S. Secretary of Commerce Gina Raimondo says a 21st century workforce must be climate literate.
If we're going to ensure that American workers can take advantage of the jobs that we're creating, then we have to be proactive about training folks so they have the skills they need to get the jobs that are available.
The program is one of 9 climate-related job programs nationwide funded by the Inflation Reduction Act and focused on economically disadvantaged communities, which often face disproportionate impacts from climate change. I'm Catherine Carley reporting.
Hurricane season is here, and conservationists are shining a light on the role salt marshes play in protecting coastal North Carolina communities. Studies find that these marshes absorb floodwaters, reducing property damage in nearby areas by an average of 20%. Biologist Charlie Deaton with the North Carolina Division of Marine Fisheries explains what salt marshes do to help build climate resilience.
They're good at helping us actually mitigate some of the carbon we've released into the atmosphere, and they are good for community resilience, too. They protect landward shorelines from erosion, and salt marshes, larger scales, can actually reduce the impacts of storm surge and reduce flooding from that.
North Carolina has about 220,000 acres of salt marshes, but the protections they offer are dependent on their health and preservation. Coastal development, pollution, and climate change all pose threats to these ecosystems. And this weekend is Father's Day, and it will be tough for kids with a dad in jail or prison. More than 200,000 kids in Michigan have an incarcerated parent at some point in their lives. Statistics show an overwhelming percentage of those parents are fathers. Crystal Blair spoke with one of them and has this report.
48-year-old Tory Price was released from a Michigan prison last February after serving 17 years for armed robbery, a crime he says was fueled by a struggle with drug addiction. At the time, his son was only 2. Behind bars, Price says he connected with organizations, including the University of Michigan, to learn how to become an advocate for incarcerated parents.
Very passionate about helping folks that are still inside, about parents that are still inside. And, you know, because today my son is 13 now, and because people advocated for me, we have a great relationship.
Price has expressed deep remorse for his crimes and says he's grateful to his family and supportive organizations for helping him maintain the father-son relationship while he was incarcerated. Crystal Blair reporting.
And this is Mike Moen for Public News Service. Member and listener supported, heard on interesting radio stations and your favorite podcast platform. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
Hello and welcome to the better weather for Friday, June 14th. Local early morning temperatures range from 60 degrees in Steventown to 70 in Skodak. Regional average soil temperature is 63 degrees. Pollen levels for today will be medium. Today is going to be stormy. I can already see it on the radar. Due to hit our region around 9 a.m., it will last all day. Thunder is possible, but there won't be damaging winds. A high of 78 lingers most of the day. Things get comfortable by, about midnight, and we see a low of 60 degrees. Then, tomorrow will be a little windy with a high of 75 at 3 p.m. If you head out early, you may actually need a hoodie or a jacket. A very comfortable 59 degrees overnight takes us into a mostly sunny Sunday with a high of 77. Monday, high of 88, and we get heat indexes over 100 by the end of the week. Get those ACs installed now. If someone is being stubborn, at least make sure they have a good fan and access to cool running water. Room temperatures in places could reach body temperature, and that is dangerous. Speaking of cool running water, today's tide schedule is low tide at 4 a.m., high tide at 9:41 a.m., low tide again at 4:31 p.m., then high tide once again at 10:28 p.m. Today's river temperature will be 73 degrees and the tide strength will be low. Sunset today will be at 8:18 p.m. Sunrise tomorrow will be at 5:15 a.m. Looking way up, we see X-class flare chances are at 5%. Plasma winds will be slow at 343 kilometers per second with a thin density of 1 proton per cubic centimeter. Radio propagation conditions are currently fair below 8 MHz till dark, then fair below 60 MHz overnight. There are no chances for aurora this evening. The current sunspot number is 124. And this has been the better weather for Friday, June 14th, brought to you by the Catskill Makers Syndicate.
Say, Dad, I have an upset stomach.
I've got just the thing. Dr. Whitaker's Larded Atoms. Dr. Whitaker's Larded Atoms combine the smooth, pleasing flavor of lard with the soothing qualities brought to us through science.
It smells funny.
That's our special ingredient, uranium, the scent of the powerful atom. It's strong, but that's how you know it's working. Feeling better yet, sweetheart?
Sure am. Thanks, Dad.
Don't thank me. Thank science.
Dr. Whitaker's Larded Atoms in 5 or 10 ounce bottles at your local grocer.
If you think you're smart, then use your cranium. Start each morning with uranium.
Life itself announcing itself through you, and the sooner we recognize that, that is to say recognize it, that is to say know it again, the sooner we allow ourselves to know that again, the cleaner we can be in dealing with it. We can announce our agendas to each other. We can declare our truth. We can say what's so, and everybody can be holding 5 cards. And then we can play a winning. There's nothing unsaid, nothing unspoken, and it's all out there. And so whether we're talking about it at that more universally understood level of what sex is, or whether we're talking about it at the higher level that I first described, in any form, creating a synergistic energy exchange. Either way, sex comes before love, because in the absence of that synergistic energy exchange, sex would not even be possible, nor would love. In fact, nothing would be possible. So I didn't mean to trick you, but really to use this device to cause you to look at really what's truly happening. is the first I'm excited being in the room with.
That was side A of Hudson DJ SVB's 2018 release. That was Synergistic Energy Exchange, Disco is Long Life, from SVB on 90.7 FM WGXC.
Hi, this is Rodney Greenblatt from Catskill, and you're listening to WGXC, Acra, 90.7 FM.
La despensa de alimentos de Catskill está localizada en la parroquia de la Iglesia de St. Luke en Catskill, en la calle William, número 50. La despensa está abierta todos los viernes de la 1 hasta las 4 de la tarde. La comida sana es un derecho. Para más información, bienvenidos a todos a venir. Llamar por teléfono a 551-299-2456. Mirar la página web catskillfoodpantry.org o conectar con nosotros en Facebook en Catskill Food Pantry.
Next, we have an interview from
WOOC.
To learn more about this program, the Sanctuary for Independent Media, visit us online at mediasanctuary.org.
Coming up is Flags Day. When is it? Where is it? What is it all about? Can you each introduce yourselves for our listeners?
I'm Hannah Vanderkolk.
I'm EP or Elizabeth Press, and we make up 2/3 of the Flags Day collective. Angela couldn't join us this morning.
To each of you, what is your involvement in Flags Day?
As EP was mentioning, EP, Angela, and I came together to form the Flags Day collective in 2018-2019. Troy used to have a large Flag Day celebration, a national holiday. And when it ended in 2018, we came together to offer Flags Day, adding three S's to the name. And so we're the primary organizers, though it's really a community event that a lot of people are involved in.
Anything you want to add, EP?
I think we'll probably get into what Flags Day itself is, but, you know, our tagline is, you know, being yourself in community, a roving party to be yourself in community. And we really look forward to this moment of celebration in the streets with our community for Flags Day and sometimes beyond.
Gotcha. So what is Flag Day, the holiday? And what is Flags Day with three S's? How do you differentiate them?
Well, Flag Day is a national holiday that goes way back, I think, but the a real significant change in it happened in the 1960s when there were widespread anti-war protests around the war in Vietnam, and Flag Day kind of was taken up as an anti-Vietnam War protest and was made to be pretty nationalistic and even militaristic. So that is the history of it. In Troy, it was really a large parade that a lot of people were involved in. And we think probably we've heard not necessarily everyone connected it to being nationalistic or militaristic, but it does have that residue with the history of where it comes from. Is that right, EP?
Yeah, and then, you know, to add on to that or to continue with the second half of your question, you know, Flag Day, the Flag Day Organizing Committee stopped that celebration in Troy in 2017. And we decided as the Flags Day Collective to, you know, still use this date, and but to expand it. So, you know, we seek to add something in terms of multiplicities and thinking beyond just the American flag and thinking about how we can celebrate in the streets being more than, you know, this patriotic war anti-dissent holiday and sort of putting our own twist to it, bringing, you know, dissent and joy and really just thinking, you know, bigger than this and how we can enjoy each other on the streets of Troy.
And EP mentioned joy and celebration, and those are definitely big features. And I think at the same time, part of Flags Day is a kind of grieving and a space to feel into what we want to transform in locally and nationally. And at this time, that feels particularly potent with the war in Gaza and it being just very clear right now, the lengths to which the U.S. and other governments will go to use their military might. So I think it's a celebratory thing, and it's a space for us to be together in grief and, as EP said, dissent. So that's some of where we're coming from with it.
Gotcha. Go ahead.
I was just going to say, and every year we sort of pick a theme that plays with this push and pull of dissent, of grieving, of mourning, of celebration, and where we sort of meet those things. And early on this year, we picked the theme of plastic. The first one was about multiplicities. We had a Flags Day related to the elections. And so we are sort of, you know, this year really honing in on the idea of the theme of plastic jubilee. So we are asking people to, wear their trash, make stuff from their recycling bin, find and sort of just meditate on just how much plastic is in us, around us. And so this is how we'll sort of lead with this, you know, plastic related to what Hannah said in terms of war, plastic in terms of just how it is everywhere in our environment and ourselves.
So what have been some other themes in previous years?
Our first year was focused on other species and the borderlessness of how other species live. So we really featured like bees and hummingbirds and animals that remind us that borders are human created and artificial, so that a single flag is something that's really just relevant to humans, but in the rest of the world, there's this multiplicity. And then we've done some special events, as EP mentioned, around the election in 2020. And then we have also done a kind of offshoot branch of our project that's around crows. And those are winter parades and rituals that are connected to honoring the crow population in Troy.
Gotcha. So why three S's? Tell me the story behind that.
Well, I think, you know, it's sort of like the play on being bigger than the one flag day. I don't think necessarily there is a huge significance to three, but many is important. And in some way, there's three of us organizing this as the core of the Flags Day collective. So we landed with that as the number of extra S's for multiple flags, multiple ways of identifying.
Cool. What kind of prep goes into Flags Day? How long have you been planning?
In some ways, we're now, like, since we had our first procession in 2019, in some ways, we're always threading one to the next, and there's always some degree of preparing and thinking going on. But it shifts parade to parade how much preparation. But for this one, we had two art builds where we had people come together and work on flags and costumes. We provide some materials, we provide some templates if people don't have their own projects they're working on that they can jump in on. People of all ages have come to those. We've done those at Oakwood, we've done those at Refuge in Troy, and so this time we had two of those last week. This year we have a very exciting new thing, which is that we have a live band, which we've never had before. We've always had recorded music that we pull a sound system on a cart, and we have a 20-person brass band, Funk Rust, coming from Brooklyn, and so a lot of preparations going into coordinating with them, making sure they have places to stay and we're going to feed them and stuff like that. We also have a marshals team, so we have a crew of people that are going to help keep the procession safe, interact with the traffic. So coordinating that. And then we have it, Flags Corps, a group of flag dancers that will be kind of at the head of the procession, helping keep the pace and helping us look cute. And yeah, what else goes into an EP?
Well, I think, you know, for us, it's really been exciting to have this level of engagement in the prep. Last year, we had a redistribution grant from the Art Center that, you know, changed it a bit. This year, we're back to doing it in our scrappy sort of grassroots manner, which is really exciting to see who is excited to help make Flags Day happen. And it's really sweet to engage more than just the three of us in these workshops and really get, you know, there's youth that come, there's, you know, artists that want to come and make their own costumes and flags. So we'll have extra flags available if you want to come to Flags Day on Friday, June 14th. We're meeting at Riverfront Park in downtown Troy, and we'll have extra flags, but you're more than welcome to express yourself creatively and make your own plastic creation to bring along in our procession.
Perfect. That was my next question. In the minute we have left is, you know, when and where is it? And is there somewhere people can go to find out more and get involved?
Yeah, a couple things. We'll meet at 5:30 this coming Friday, the 14th, at Riverfront Park, and we'll aim to start processing around town at 6. You know, as we said, there's a huge band, so if you miss us at 6, you can probably listen for us somewhere in the downtown and find us and jump in. And we'll process till around 7:30. We have a website, flagsday.org, with 3 S's.
And I'll just say, also this year we're having an after party. There will be not only the 20-piece band, Funk Rest Brass Band, but there'll be another band playing called Brasskill from down in Hudson. And you need RSVP for that party. So if you're interested in coming to the Flags Day party, you just need to leave a voicemail at 518-328-4799. And we'll get you the details of where that after party is going to be. So there's, like, you know, the extended Flags Day celebration will go on into a show with these brass bands later on at night.
Awesome. Well, I could continue asking you more questions for a whole other length of an interview, but unfortunately we're out of time. Thank you both for joining me and doing this, and best of luck on Friday.
Thank you. Thank you, Lavender.
Hope to see you all in the streets.
That interview was from
WOOC.
To learn more about this program, the Sanctuary for Independent Media, visit us online at mediasanctuary.org.
Of the threefold universe, the Tao is supreme. In my body is a golden light. I am completely bathed in it. Looking, I cannot see it. Listening, I cannot hear it. It surrounds heaven and earth. It nurtures all. Reciting this scripture 10,000 times, my body shines bright. Protected within the threefold universe, the 5 emperors welcome me. The 10,000 spirits assemble. a thunderclap issues. Ghosts and demons are terror-stricken. Evil spirits are carried away. A thunderbolt comes from within. The thunder god remains hidden. Penetrating wisdom pervades. The five chi steam and seethe. Golden light flashes, covering and guarding the perfected.
Thank you.
That was Side B of a 2018 local release from DJ SVB from Hudson. It was Force Field and Same Old Blues and Mirror Soul from SVB on WGXC.
Calling all radio enthusiasts. Have you ever wanted to be on the radio or learn how to edit audio? Got a great idea for a short segment to play during our drive time shows? Start making radio with us at WGXE 90.7 FM as part of the WGXE Community Contributors Program. No prior experience needed. For more information, contact content at WGXE.org. That is content at WGXE.org.
Today's excerpt of the Nature Calls podcast from the Master Gardeners at Cornell Cooperative Extension for Green and Columbia Counties is all about winter birds.
I'm your host, Tim Kenalty.
And I'm Jean Thomas.
Jean, how you doing today?
I'm doing so good. It's just indescribable.
We're going to talk about birds today on today's episode, right?
Oh, we have Catherine Schneider with us, and she is such a phenomenal expert.
We're really lucky to have her as a Master Gardener volunteer. She has a PhD in ornithology, and she knows all things birds. She's my go-to bird person.
And she's written a book about specifically birding in the Hudson Valley, so she knows our territory.
And we're going to talk about feeding birds in winter. I think it's appropriate. And she has all the do's and don'ts and a lot of really interesting information.
So, Catherine, welcome. And we'd like to ask you first about your educational and professional background and what got you interested in birds.
Well, my mom was a bird watcher, so I grew up seeing and identifying birds. There were field guides in my house, and I was part of an outdoorsy family. We spent summers in the Adirondacks, and I grew up with an interest in nature. So it was fairly logical that I would go to college as a biology major at Cornell, and it was there at Cornell that I got hooked on birds. I discovered that if you worked really hard and were good at what you did, you might actually be able to get a job that involves studying birds. So from Cornell, I went on to Princeton, where I studied dominance hierarchies and winter flocks of white-throated sparrows, and I earned my master's and PhD there. Most of my professional life has been spent teaching college biology or working for conservation organizations on bird projects related to habitat protection. I retired from teaching a few years ago, and that's when I wrote my book. Basically, I wrote the book because I wanted to share what I'd learned about birds in the Hudson Valley.
Wow, Catherine, we are so lucky to have you here. Welcome. So many people feed the birds in the winter, and in fact, I read that according to Cornell Lab of Ornithology, 55 million people feed wild birds, which is just so many. Does this mean we're keeping the birds alive in the winter when the food's scarce, or is it more about us being able to see beautiful birds on our decks and backyard?
Well, to be perfectly honest, it's mostly about us. Bird feeders make it easy for us to see birds and to learn about them. We like to think that we're helping them out, but the birds really don't need us. I don't know of any scientific evidence that shows that they wouldn't survive without us. They are perfectly capable of finding their own food, but they're not above taking a free lunch if it's made available to them. We're probably making life a little easier for them because birds have a very high metabolic rate and they have to eat in winter to generate heat and to stay warm.
There's so many different seed mixes, types of seeds, cakes, etc. So tell us a little bit about what types of food we should actually be feeding the birds.
They need lots of calories to generate heat inside their bodies. And their bills are designed by evolution to harvest only certain types of food. So, for example, seed eaters, birds that are eating things like sunflower seed as your feeder, or house finches that might be eating millet, they're actually using their bill shape to husk the seeds and to get at that high energy kernel inside. A woodpecker has a bill that's designed to dig insect larvae out of wood. You're probably not going to provide a woodpecker with caterpillars, but you can provide food like suet that is basically animal matter, like the larvae that they would normally find and eat in nature. Woodpeckers, of course, with that pointed bill, aren't particularly good at harvesting seeds. So birds don't have hands like we do, but they have bills, and those bills are designed to eat certain kinds of food. So what I like to do with my feeders, because I like to attract lots of different kinds of birds, is to provide different kinds of food, small seed for birds with small bills, animal matter in the form of suet for birds that would normally eat that kind of food, and other things like thistle seed, for example, for a bird like a goldfinch that would normally eat that kind of a shaped seed in nature. I like to offer different kinds of food in different kinds of settings. So I have lots of different kinds of feeders and in different locations. So there are some birds, for example, that would never take a seed out of a tubular feeder. They'd much prefer to take food off a platform, a flat surface. Other birds prefer to feed on the ground near cover. Lots of birds like to take food off bark. So I have a feeder that has holes in it and provides something like suet in holes that I've drilled into the wood. So lots of different kinds of food in lots of kinds of locations and different kinds of presentations will get you a lot of diversity at your feeders.
What about feeding fruit? And what if I mix my own suet cakes? How does that work?
That can be okay. It's a lot of fun to make your own food. There are actually even cookbooks out there for making bird food in winter. The important thing to do is to not feed birds anything they can't or shouldn't eat. So bread comes to mind. Many people feed bread to ducks and geese, and that's not a good idea because bread has very little nutritional value. You want to try and feed birds something that is close to what they might eat in nature. And in places where there are signs that I've seen, don't feed the ducks bread, bring frozen peas instead, because many birds like mallards, for example, are basically eating aquatic vegetation. So if you feed them peas, you're basically feeding them plants, which is sort of close to what they would eat. You also want to be really careful not to feed birds any food that is spoiled or moldy. Honey in particular tends to go moldy really quickly, and it's not like the nectar that is found in nature. So moldy or spoiled food is definitely out. Processed or salty foods aren't a particularly good idea because they increase the demand for water, which is also in short supply in winter. And then there are some foods that birds are unable to digest. Just like dogs shouldn't be given chocolate, apparently birds have problems with chocolate, milk, and avocados are apparently somewhat toxic to birds. So the best thing to do is to try and mimic what they would find in nature. There's a writer named Julie Zickenfuss who has actually made a study of what birds need in winter, and she's designed a food, what she calls Zikdo, and it's a mixture of lard and peanut butter, which of course has a lot of protein in it, and cornmeal, and has other ingredients, but it's great fun to melt a whole container of lard and peanut butter in your microwave and then add the dry material and then feed this to the birds. It's too rich for them to eat in summer, but in winter, it's a really good high energy, high protein food. So I think you should experiment, but just be careful what you feed them.
I can't believe you're talking about Zikdo because I've made it, my sister's made it, and now I have a big bag of chicken feed and no chickens, but it's great and the birds really love it. I assume that, and I know you kind of covered this, but with different seeds and suet, you're going to get different kinds of birds if you have different kinds of feed out on your deck or at your feeder. Is that correct?
Yes, they prefer what they can harvest efficiently, but basically what fits in their bill. And something close to what they might eat in nature. So as I said, the Niger, or sometimes it's called thistle seed, is beloved by finches who normally eat that kind of seed in nature. Other things like sunflower fits into the bills, mostly of bigger birds, but all of them love it. And I think it's because there's a diversity of size in the black oil sunflower seed. But they'll generally try and find a kind of seed that fits in the bill and that they have to peel it. They have to take the outer husk off, even small round seed like millet. You watch those white-throated sparrows eating millet, and they spin it around in the very tip of their bill and peel off the outside coating and eat the endosperm, which is the energy-rich part of the seed.
So what types of birds should I expect to see at my feeder?
The birds we see at our feeder are mostly what we call permanent residents. They're the ones that live here year-round. It may come as a surprise, but we lose a lot of our birds to migration. Some birds just decide they can't hack the winter. It's all about having enough food. So many birds, especially the birds that eat insects, tend to migrate. Our insects die, and the only insect matter that's left around for the birds that are not vegetarians are dormant things like caterpillars, for example, and pupae, and insect eggs. Birds like a chickadee, for example, will shift its diet. Most birds feed their young larvae. They feed them things like caterpillars and all. And in the summer, when they're available, a lot of birds eat almost all insect matter. But a few birds like chickadees can shift their diet and make it at least 50% plant matter. So they can eat seeds in winter, and you may see them working their way around windowsills, for example, and they're looking for dormant insects in those cases. So the birds who stay here in winter are the ones whose diets can accommodate the food that's still available. There's no flying insects, so things like warblers and swallows and all those birds that eat almost entirely insect matter are going to migrate from the area. The ones that stay are the ones that have a flexible diet or can eat dormant insects. So things like woodpeckers and nuthatches, Carolina wrens, these guys can eat dormant insects in the form of insect eggs or pupae or dead caterpillars. And then there are seed and fruit eaters. So house finches, goldfinches, cardinals, mourning doves, all the sparrows are seed eating birds. And we also see birds that get their food by taking it from the water. So waterfowl, as long as there's open water, birds that eat fish like mergansers and carnivores like Cooper's hawks, which eat other birds, they're going to be at your feeders. You won't see ducks, obviously, but you might very well see a Cooper's hawk trying to catch a bird at your feeder.
Welcome to 2024 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
No one should be celebrating this decision. This decision should have been an obvious one. And let us not forget, this decision was based not on the merits, but on a lack of standing. We are not yet out of the woods.
Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer says Democrats will have to defend the right of women and their doctors to make reproductive health decisions. The Supreme Court ruled unanimously that a pro-life group failed to show they were harmed by the FDA expanding access to abortion drug mifepristone, but the court didn't rule on the substance of the case. In another post-Roe dispute, Senate Republicans are blocking a bill to protect access to IVF. Pennsylvania Democratic Representative Susan Wild says attacks on reproductive care have spiked since Alabama Supreme Court ruled all embryos have rights, effectively banning the fertility treatment there.
Women's autonomy to make their own medical decisions should not be up for debate, and their bodies should not be pawns used by politicians to score cheap political points.
In the coming weeks, the U.S. Supreme Court could overturn or modify what's known as the Chevron deference. Currently, courts defer to federal agencies in sorting out ambiguities in areas they regulate, but Jim Murphy with the National Wildlife Federation says this conservative majority...